Tonight we're going to talk about something that is convoluted, the bane of our existence as practitioners, complicated, something we have to talk about that the very talking about it with words makes it not make any sense. And then we're going to have to use words to talk about it. But hopefully we can talk around about it and open to it and not get too tightly wound up about it. We have to talk about samadhi, concentration. And concentration is one of those words that evoke a lot of pressure, a striving. I don't know if you're anything like me. I mean, especially if you've been practicing for a long time, because I've been practicing for over 30 years, and man, I have had a relationship of concentration where there's just been a lot of striving to obtain something. And it's easier when I'm on retreat than it is when I'm just sitting here for a 40-minute sit after being busy all day. And so I want to have a conversation about concentration that's not pointed towards a retreat practice, but instead it's pointed towards our ordinary lay life as a practice. And to encourage you to believe or trust that concentration is possible even in our ordinary lay practice life. Going on retreat does make it easier, mostly because we're in a room full of people. And so somebody in that room is getting concentrated, and their concentration is helping our concentration. So we're sitting in a room where all these people are moving towards stillness and tranquility, and our nervous systems, because we are human beings, begins to relax and let go. And then the whole room begins to turn towards concentration. So there's a capacity to access it that's different than when we're at home. But I'm hoping I can talk a little bit about it in a way that you will sense it. I think I want to start with a little bit of a story that you may remember this. I've told it before. It happened a long, long, long time ago with a yogi in a class that I was teaching. We used to, at Sims, after the beginning class, we used to teach what was called a, what did we call that class? I don't remember, but it was like a, it was sort of like the Buddhist Essentials course, except it was one course, 6 weeks. It was just a continuation after the beginning class. So this was many years ago. This is over 10 years ago that this happened. But in one of the classes that I offered, there was a student who, the class was 6 weeks straight. And this student had missed a couple of weeks. They were on vacation. And so in the course of their being gone, somebody had left something out in their family. So when they got back home, the house was full of flies all over the place. And she came to the class, and she was sharing. It was the end of the class. The whole class, we've gone through it at the very end. And she goes, I have to share this. I don't even know why I have to share it, but I have to share it. I had this experience that just was mind blowing. And I can't think of anyone else to tell except for you. And so she wanted to tell us at the very end. And I said, sure, go ahead, tell us, whatever. Whatever she says, I know I'm going to understand it. But she tells this story about how when they got in the house, there were so many flies there that the father and the son, it was her son and her husband, her son and their dog. And the father and the son are whacking flies all over the house, just whacking and killing flies and grumbling and complaining. And the whole house is in a tizzy because there are flies everywhere. And at some point she gets this realization that all of this whacking of flies is killing flies, you know, who didn't ask to even be there. So she says out loud, is there any way we could get rid of the flies without killing them? And of course, her husband and her son is looking at her like she's crazy. No! And they continue to whack and kill all these flies. And she said that the whole experience seemed to reverberate in her body, this process. And she knew we got to get rid of the flies. She knew that, but somehow the reverberation of it was bothering her. And she said at some point she went into the room to take a nap. And she just, her and the dog went in, they laid down on the bed, and she heard this fly buzzing about. And her immediate thought was, oh my God, a fly is in the room. And somehow she didn't follow that impulse. She just stayed there laying on the bed and noticed that she could hear the fly buzzing about, the dog breathing, and her laying on the bed. And that was it. And she laid in this suspended moment of this fly and the dog and her lying on the bed for quite a while, and then she drifted off into sleep. She said it was so unbelievably precious. And, you know, she went back out to tell her husband about and son about this moment in time. And as soon as she said there was a fly in the bedroom, they were like, fly, fly! Just in a tizzy. So she said, it can't be, like, I'm paraphrasing here. It can't be that no one understands this. And I asked the room, which had about 60 people in it, who understands? And everybody in the room raised their hand. Everybody here understands. We understand. So what I'm talking about, even though I'm going to use words that may or may not make sense, we understand. There is an understanding about this word concentration that we already know. And we have to remember that against the backdrop of words that we have. Because the words themselves can make what is otherwise a very simple moment in time of lying on the bed with a dog breathing and a fly buzzing and completely suspended in time. It can take that moment and turn it into some convoluted confusion of striving to get somewhere. So I want to start with that story because that's what concentration is about. It is about learning how to be still in the present moment. But there's some things with concentration that we get in this second picture. I mean, this sixth story, Zen story that we're in, that we don't that we have to go through the fifth story before we can get there. Meaning that there's an important aspect to the catching the bull, the ox, taming the ox, and then riding the ox home. And what that is the necessary struggle that has to happen before we can settle into samadhi. There is a need for struggle to be there. And for the knowing of that struggle and somehow allowing it to be. This is where concentration arises out of. It arises out of the natural letting go of fixing the struggle. In that natural letting go of the need to fix the struggle, this capacity for unification of mind arises. So a way that you could think of it is that concentration itself is the ending or the fading of struggle. It's the letting go of the impulse to fix the struggle. It is coming into right relationship with struggle. And somehow it is this realization that there's no need for me to change or fix anything else. So throughout this week, the first 2 weeks of this month, we talked about how this samadhi, this ending of struggle, this lying on the back of the bull and just playing the flute and riding home. That's what that is. That's just, I'm not going to fight anymore. No, there's no struggle here. Just riding it home. And we've been talking about it in the context of just living out our everyday life. But tonight I want to talk about this in the context of your practice, of the actual meditative practice. Because one of the difficulties with lay practice, one of the benefits of going on retreat, besides the getting support from others in the hall to help you settle down, one of the reasons that going on retreat is so beneficial to practice is because of the length of time we begin to meditate. We meditate beyond the mind's ability to control our meditation. That's really what ends up happening. So, you know, that first night on a retreat or even a non-residential, I'm not even talking about some long, week-long or month-long retreat. I'm talking about a weekend. It could be a day of mindfulness. That very first sit, you know, you might can handle it. You can do that 40 minutes. I can do that. I've been used to doing it. I've been doing it a week. I can do it. 30 minutes. I can do it. But then you start getting to the second sit and the third sit and the fourth sit and all these sits, gradually the hindrances begin to float to the surface. And I'm sleepy through most of it, or I'm restless. And, you know, the energy's not right. You know, I want the bell to come, or my back is hurting. My knee is hurting. It's all this aversion and desire and doubting our ability to practice, and all of that mind starts floating up to the top. And when we practice at home as lay practitioners, we can slip into the kind of willingness to sit only till the rise of that frustration, and then we're done. That's good. I know that. So we'll sit 5 minutes or 10 minutes. We'll sit 20 minutes, 30 minutes. We'll sit. And that when that mind begins to rise, we give up because there's no one else sitting there with us. So we give up. And I want to give a talk on encouraging you not to give up, to sit after all of that crap rises and begin to sit beyond it. Because where this, where picture six, the story is pointing is beyond the struggle of the hindrances. Beyond the fighting with the mind. I think there's a way that we sometimes believe that my sit is a bad sit if I have to fight with the mind. But I want to encourage you to trust and believe that that fighting with the mind is necessary. It is a necessary part of practice. Where we fall short is that we don't sit beyond that. We stop at the fighting with the mind and give up the possibility for a greater level of mind-body unification. Unification of mind is possible if we stay beyond the fight. The discourse. So what that means is we sit down to meditate, got our commitment steady, going good. It's after work or it's in the morning or whenever we sit down, it doesn't really matter. We think it's about the timing, but really, sloth and torpor is going to show up regardless. So you think, oh, it's because I sit in the morning. Okay, I'll sit at night. Oh, it's because I sit at night. I'll sit at lunchtime. It doesn't really matter. Sloth and torpor is a hindrance, or it's not a hindrance like a problem. It is an obscuration of concentration is what I would call it. It's obscuring the concentration that is right there, right there. But it's obscuring it because in order for us to actually begin to access picture six, where we're lying on the back of the bull, we have to begin to realize that we don't actually create concentration. It arises. So instead, we are learning how to allow sleepiness to rise and try to see that I'm not sleepy. Something else is going on. I mean, you feel sleepy. Everything that sleepy feels like, that's what sloth and torpor feels like. Eyes can't stay open. Head nodding, feels like sleepiness. It's got to be sleepiness. I got to be tired. And I will tell people, you are not tired. That is concentration. Concentration is heavy. So if you don't have enough up, then your energy, the concentration that can come will bring you down. You have to have some up. So a way to think about it is, this is the way Bhante Buddhirakita helped me get past this sloth and torpor. So whenever I feel sleepy, when I'm sitting, I tell myself, that's not sleepiness. That is concentration. I don't care if I've been sitting 2 minutes. If I feel sleepy, that is concentration. That's what it is, heavy. And so what I need is uprightness. I need a lift. Concentration heavy brings you down. The lift that brings you back up is mindfulness. So mindfulness is light and uplifting, concentration heavy and grounding. So we need to balance this kind of heavy, grounded, staying kind of energy with this uplift, light, attentive energy. And so when you feel the sleepiness, if you begin to practice not with struggling not to be sleepy, it doesn't really matter whether you're sleepy or not. It's a necessary part of practice. So if sleepiness arises, then we have to see that as this is a moment, an opportunity, a moment to cultivate concentration. And you cultivate it by beginning to turn towards, how do I lighten the energy by turning towards mindfulness? Mindfulness is like turning your attention towards something and getting interested in it. I don't care what you turn your attention towards. That's why I left the fans on. I don't know what it sounded like for those of you online. I just left the fans on. So it's like, turn your attention towards that sound. It's blasting all in our ears. It's here. So turn your attention towards this sound and begin to get interested in it. Not interested like cognizing, thinking through what is this? What is fans? How do the fans work? It's not that kind of interest. It is interested in hearing, interested in the ebb and the flow of sound, interested in the how close it is, how far away it is, how soft it is, how harsh it is, interested in hearing itself, interested in sensation itself, how it feels. Does it stay? Is it permanent? Does it move? You get interested in it, and all of a sudden, the sleepiness no longer becomes the heaviness that it is. So we need that struggle of the hindrances to keep us steady, to keep us here, to keep us engaged in the moment. And cultivate samadhi. Without the hindrances, we would not have any samadhi. We would not have the capacity for the unification of mind. This unification of mind that I'm talking about is sort of like an awareness of I'm going to say it differently. Oftentimes when we think about, when I hear people talk about concentration, or I hear people talk about this knowing that they're in concentration, knowing they're concentrated, the way it's described is almost like it's a pleasurable experience of stillness and peace and bliss, and feels so pleasant, seems so pleasant. So in order for me to be concentrated, I must be having a pleasant kind of experience. And so many people, when your back is aching or you're having some constant thinking, there's a thought that I can't be concentrated because it's not pleasant. It's not blissful and peaceful. That is not concentration. You can have concentration that way. And there is a way in which we could get in deep absorption. And it can be very blissful. But that is not the concentration that we need for awakening, this kind of absorbed into bliss. The kind of concentration we need to cultivate for awakening is an absolute knowing of the present moment. We are more and more and more awake in the present moment. We have not transcended into some altered state of mind where I'm gone somewhere and I don't even know what's going on around me. The concentration that we're trying to cultivate is a level of concentration that is the mind's ability to stay in the present moment. There's a Zen master that said, clear days are weather. Rainy days are weather. Cloudy days are weather. Hailing days are weather. So he said, every day is a good day. And for many years, he said to a lot of students, I'm not going to ask you about the 15 days before this day. I'm not going to ask you about the 15 days that's going to follow, but just about this very day. How is it right now? And no one ever answered the question. So finally, when he was like 80 years old, somebody asked him, can you give us the answer to the question? How is it right now? He said, every day is a good day. That's what he started with. He said, every day is a good day. I'm not going to ask you about the last 15. I'm not going to ask you about the 15 in the future. I just want to know, how is it right now? So how is it right now for you? And all these students would get contemplating in the mind. Nobody could answer. All these students, he was very famous. All these students cannot answer this question. He's 80 years old now. He probably started teaching when he was like 30, 50 years. He's been trying to get someone to answer that question. So somebody asked him, what's the answer, oh great one? He said, every day is a good day. Kind of burying the lead kind of thing, you know? I'm using that is, I'm trying to say that when we are sitting, whatever is arising with you, you pay attention to that. Because that right there, whatever it is something that you can pay attention to. If you're sitting and you're trying to pay attention to something that's not present, then you are not present. So if you are having a lot of distracting thoughts and you try your best to pay attention to a peaceful mind, then you can create the idea of a peaceful mind, but you won't actually experience a peaceful mind. So the goal then for getting to this kind of peaceful mind has to come from the struggle that happens with a distracted mind. And that struggle is what leads to a peaceful mind. The reason why it leads to a peaceful mind is because the struggle itself is the only way to see. I know this isn't gonna, I probably should get some poems out to help me a little bit here. The struggle is the only way to see that you cannot win. here's something Ian would say it much better than me. I'll first read, wait a minute. Let me see if I can find the old one I had. This is good. He says, life is like bailing a boat with a hole in it. So let's say meditation is like bailing a boat with a hole in it. No matter how fast you work, no matter how large our pail, no matter how many friends help us, water continues to pour in. But what if we accept the fact that our boat has a hole in it, and sooner or later, it will sink? We continue to bail without the hope of steaming the water. But because bailing is the stuff of life, because bailing is the stuff of meditation, now freed from the craving to solve the tragedy of our existence or the tragedy of this particular meditation, we turn our eyes to the heavens above and bask in the wonder and joy of the futility of it all. Don't worry, things will get worse. There is a way in which I'm trying to point to a willingness to put some struggle in your sit. I'm trying to encourage you to put some difficulty in the practice, not to look for sits that are smooth and easy. If that sit is smooth and easy, stay there a little bit longer. Don't get up. So let's say you sit 10 minutes and it's smooth and easy. Well, stay 20. And I guarantee you, when that 10 o'clock bell, when that 10 minute bell rings and the mind thinks it's time to get up now, you stay longer. You will begin to see the drama of the mind coming. When you start seeing the drama of the mind coming, you are pretty much in this kind of the fifth story. You're in the catching, taming, fighting with the mind. You need that. That's what I'm pointing to. You need that. I wish it wasn't like this energy. But in the practice, instead of trying to solve the problem, see if you can get still or get patient or be willing to let the angst of the mind just be there. Let the mind grumble about the time. Let the urgency of, oh my God, we better get up because I'm going to be late. Let that be there. Just let it be there. Let the irritation, the annoyance, all of that. Let the sleepiness be there. And instead, pay attention. Because what begins to happen, what we cannot see until after the struggle, is we cannot see what happens in the mind when it releases its struggle itself. That's what we are looking for. If you release the struggle by getting up, or you release the struggle by changing your sit so you're not sleepy anymore, or you release the struggle by sitting less so I won't have any anxiety, you won't see this capacity of mind to unify itself. So what we need is a struggle that we ultimately stop fighting against. And when we stop fighting against it, then we can begin to see how the mind on its own will let go. Another reflection by Ian. A young novice returned to his master after a year in the forest alone. So that's some serious practice. I'm still lost in thoughts. I miss my family and friends, and I can't quiet my mind. I am miserable. Good, replied the master. How could that be good? The first step to liberation is to experience that suffering is inherent in being born. And the next step, said the novice, it is to realize that this suffering, and of course the novice interrupts and says, is good? Master says, no, suffering is not good. Then what is good? The ability to observe suffering is good. That is so contrary. Can you see the dog and the fly in that moment? It's so contrary to the way we're taught. It's so contrary to the way we think. So as soon as we start having a difficult sit, the natural sort of samsaric way of being with it is to figure out a way to make it peaceful, to make it soft, to make it good, to make it better. And we put all our efforts into making the sit better. Sitting, we change our posture so I don't have any pain anymore. Change my time so I'm not sleepy. Do all these things, cut out the sit. We do all these things to make it so that we don't have the difficulty, thinking that that will make concentration, the bliss of concentration, come. And I am pointing to the opposite direction. I'm saying, be happy if you have some hindrances there, because it's like muscle work, tension, building it up. There's a story oftentimes that teachers will tell you that there's two ways, there's two levels of practice. First level is it's the story that they use is like a goat herder. We don't really think about goat herding because we don't goat herd, but I'm going to use this story of a goat herder. You got your goats and you got to get them up to the top of the mountain where there's a big grassy field and you can let them roam. So you got to go down the street. And we've seen pictures and stories. We've seen goats, goat herders with goats or sheep or whatever, trying to get them down the street. And all along the way, there's all this grass that just grows by the side of the road. So the goats or the sheep, they want to eat that grass. Why we got to get up the hill? Let's eat this grass. But there's cars and there's, you know, other farmland, and you got to be careful about where the sheep is and get them out of the way. So you're constantly tapping these sheep to get them to go, nope, 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 nope. And they're like, let's eat here. Like, nope, nope, keep it moving, keep it moving. This is what we're doing in picture five. This kind of, discipline and effort. It's right effort. And the right effort is not to make your sit better. The right effort is the effort it takes to stay with the difficulty, to stay there with it. Pay attention to it. Don't be so quick to smooth it out. You're all that effort. Come, 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 come. For as long as it takes, eventually, the goat get up to the field, the sheep get up to the field. And then you can sit under the tree And the sheep can just wander and eat until they're through eating. Sit down and eat some more. And you can just sit there. That's your job. Your main job is the getting them to that field. So the main job that we have as practitioners is to keep the mind steady with difficulty. Keep the mind present and awake and aware when it's difficult and you want to get away from that difficulty. Stay there, stay there, stay there. Tap, 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 tap. Stay here. Stay interested. Stay alive, paying attention, watching here and there. And eventually you get into this field and the mind, you do not have to tap, tap, tap anymore. The mind will just stay there and things can come and go and you don't have to force the mind to pay attention anymore. This tap, 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 this staying with the difficult, staying with the difficult, that is called directed mind. You're directing thought intentionally, paying attention to what's happening, directing your attention to this moment, to this moment, to this moment. You're not grumbling about the distracted thinking. You don't care. Oh, well, at least I got something to do. Every time I wake up, I just keep coming back. There you go. Happy about that. This knowing that when the mind goes off and it comes back and you bring it back, you are directing thought, and you're cultivating the capacity for concentration. And it's going to seem like you got to direct the mind back a million times. You just keep doing it. You don't care. You're not upset. That's something for you to do. As soon as you know you're lost in thought, I have something to do. Come back. Direct it back. Direct it back. Direct it back. You have the anchor. You create some anchor, sound, sensation, breath, whatever. The anchor is so that you have something to come back to. Something that you will notice that you've left and you come back to. That is picture 5. Directed thought. Picture 6, undirected thought. You've landed in the big field and now you don't have to direct, 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 direct. Sometimes that undirected concentration can be peaceful. Pleasant. Sometimes it's not necessarily pleasant, but it's peaceful. Sometimes it's neither. It's not pleasant, not unpleasant. It's just present. It's not a state that you're striving to have a peaceful existence. It is a state that you are striving to be able to let go of needing to direct and control the moment. And you can just sit there. You can just lie there. You can just be there in that moment as it is without this need to make it be a certain way. That's what you're moving towards. That's what you're aiming towards. That's what we're working towards, is this ability to be in the moment without any more need to control it. And when we let go of that need to control the moment, there is so much. It's such a different way of perceiving life when we don't have to control how it is. This is the last thing I want to leave you with. Ian says, the crazed one entered the town shouting, I have lost my head. I can't find my head. The townsfolk caught hold of the man and brought him to the elder. The elder held up the mirror to the man. I found it, he shouted. the townsfolk all laughed at the crazed man who left the village happy with his mirror. He can see his head. "Why do you laugh?" the elder asked. "You too are crazed. You too look outside yourself for what you already have. All you need lies within you. You search for happiness. It is in your heart. You search for truth. It is in your mind. You search for gold. It is in your smile. You search for beauty. It is in your eyes. You search for another to fulfill you. When it is you yourself, you should seek." This picture points at the end towards returning home. That's the point of this story, returning home. And in meditation, the phrase returning home means you're returning to this body. That there is a sense that being right here with this body, no matter what is arising, is sufficient, is wisdom. There is something to be seen, something to be known, something to be understood in this moment with this body right here, right now. Not after you fixed everything, but right here in the sleepiness, in the restlessness, in the doubt, all of it. In this moment, there is something to be understood. We'll sit for 1 minute here, or a couple seconds. Thank you so much for your kind attention. Let's see if anybody has any questions. And I hope you're not confused about concentration. It's all cleared up. We all got it down now. It's like, "Oh, thank you, Terry. You really helped clear it up for me." That's good. Yeah, come on, Deb.
I thought it was very interesting, Terry, about talking about sleepiness as a preponderance of concentration. Because I was falling asleep tonight. You know, don't take it personal. But I kind of caught myself leaning forward, about to tumble off the chair onto the floor. I had to like pull up. It would have been so embarrassing. That was what I was aware of. Like, wow, this would really be embarrassing if I fell off this chair. And then I tried to remember about, okay, embodiment. Where am I right now? I'm in this chair. I'm in this room. There's sunlight in my eyes. There's wind. And, you know, just where am I right now? So is that part of what the addition of lightness would be to balance out the concentration?
That's what I think it is. I think it's kind of a weird thing, because when we think of concentration, mostly we're always talking about absorption. Like, you know, being lost or being absorbed in a moment. And that takes a lot of effort in, and it takes a lot of steadiness of mind. But I'm not talking about that type of concentration. I'm talking about the type of concentration that will keep you right here. So one way to think about it is, if you wanted to think about what I'm saying you're concentrated on sleepiness. That's what it is. So you're trying to bring attention. That's it. You can open your eyes. That brings energy. It brings attention. You can start paying attention. You could move your head.
Yeah, I did open my eyes, and I did kind of squirm a little bit. I was aware that my back was a little tired, and I was fidgeting a little bit with that then, but at least it was more like light coming into my eyes and
right.
things like that. Yeah.
Okay. But what I want to point to that this picture five, the picture before this picture is saying is that when you're sleepy, not try to not be sleepy, right? Because usually we think sleepiness is the problem. If I wake up now, I'm going to be able to be concentrated. And what I'm saying is use the mindfulness to understand sleepiness, to use that, like, it doesn't matter if you fall asleep in meditation. I mean, I think Buddha probably fell asleep in meditation. That's some of the best sleep ever. So sort of like, why it, the sleepiness is not the problem. The sleepiness comes from all kinds of factors, your energy level, the heat, everything. It's all there. So what you're trying to do is use this moment as an investigation into the nature of the truth of whether you're sleepy. Because in truth, as soon as the bell rings or, you know, the meditation's over,
right,
bing,
I'm not,
or
I'm
right
not,
away,
I'm not sleepy
no
well.
Sleepy.
Yeah.
Everything's good. So where is that sleep? What was that? So what we want to use is the investigation not to get rid of the sleepiness, but to instead of struggle and fix the sleepiness, we want to use this investigation to understand the fallacy of the sleepiness. That means you're going to still be sleepy. You're still going to maybe even fall asleep. You know, you're not going to fall off the chair. I've never really seen anyone do that, but it can feel like you're going to.
It did. I was at a 45 degree angle.
Yeah. I've been sleepy like that before.
So what would be one question that a practitioner could frame for herself to pursue this line of inquiry that you're talking about?
I don't think you can use it as a question because I think that's what gets us tripped up. If you use it as a question, then you're going to, then you're going to get into trying to solve the sleepiness. The question is there to help you solve the question, sleepiness. A way to think about it is to kind of accept this notion, sleepiness is obscuring my wisdom. This sleepiness is obscuring my sort of liberation, my concentration, my ability to be right here. So you want to know, how is this, am I sleepy? That could be, am I really sleepy? Or is this really just a cloud obscuration? Hmm. Right? Because like clouds in the sky look thick and real. But when you fly up through them, there's nothing there.
Yeah.
So how, but they look real. So the sleepiness looks real. It feels real, like it's sleepiness, but it's not. And so you want to try to see if you can challenge that idea that you are sleepy. And that's what you're trying to do. It could be a phrase that you come up with. It could be something that you do. It could be anything. That it could just be a mantra. I am not really sleepy. You know, it could be anything.
Would it be all right if I stood up?
You could stand up, but if the standing up is to get you to not be sleepy, then you're using a solution. You're trying to have a solution here.
Okay.
So yes, we do stand up. So standing up is good. Opening your eyes, same thing. People don't necessarily stand up. They could. But people also open their eyes. But what I'm trying to point to is don't make it about getting rid of the sleepiness.
Okay.
Make it about challenging whether that sleepiness is actually true. Mm. Because I have a feeling that oftentimes what we call sleepiness is really when the meditation is beginning to get very peaceful, very easy, very soft. And then all of a sudden the mind is like, we're riding that soft easiness and we start getting sleepy. Instead, if we paid attention when we started getting easy and soft, then we would not fall into the sleepiness. But we have to first see that that sleepiness is not real. So I'm trying to encourage you not to try to get rid of the sleepiness, but to investigate the whole truth of whether you're really sleepy.
I understand. Thank you.
You see?
Okay.
I think if you investigate that, maybe I can say one more thing. I used to come out of meditation because I was cold. I would get cold and because I got cold, I couldn't meditate when I was cold. So you guys know I always wear shawls and all of that because I got to be warm in order to meditate. And so I remember when Carol Wilson one time asked me, well, why do you get cold? And I'm thinking, I don't know. I don't do that. And she goes, well, then heat yourself back up again. You know, I did not know what this woman was talking about. But I went back to the sit. And I kept trying to see why I was getting cold or understand what was happening. And then I noticed that I started getting cold. And I remembered that this yogi next to me was opening the window and she wasn't supposed to. So I was all mad and I was cussing her out. That's why I get cold, because she is opening that window and that's what's making me cold. So in big fight, I come out of my meditation. I decided I was going to go over there and slam the whole window and just disrupt the whole hall. I didn't care. My sit was messed up. I'm messing up the whole hall. So I come out of my sit and I look over and the window is not open. So how? I realized the whole coldness was made up. It's all very much made up in the mind. What I was calling feeling cold was getting sensitive so I could feel air. I could feel the wind. I could feel the movement of air and I could feel it and it would feel like getting cold to me. But I noticed that if I started paying attention to anything like the felt sense of the pressure of my feet on the floor and whether that pressure was even or was 1 foot more down than the other foot, then all of a sudden that interest would start generating all this heat and I would start getting hot again. But we won't actually learn this if we don't, in the midst of our meditation behind the eyes all by ourselves, challenge what we think is happening. And that it's not fighting it. It's challenging whether it's true is what you want to do.
Okay.
So you want to use that as a way to kind of challenge it.
Okay. That's helpful discernment.
Yeah. You
Thank
see?
You. Thank you.
All right. Good. Everybody see that, what I'm saying? I probably put Deborah on the spot to make her sit there the whole time. I probably should have said, oh, you can go back to your seat now. You don't have to sit right there. But I'm trying to help everyone welcome the difficulty in your sit. I want you to welcome it. And when the mind feels like it's very tight or anxious or upset, welcome that as whether or not that's actually true. Yeah, Carlito?
Hey there. Oops. Got some echo. Yeah.
Yeah, you're good.
Okay, good. So the last line of the poem that you read, "Abandon hope, all ye who enter here." Because you then, you know, the next line is that, and so you need faith. What is that actually referring to in your mind?
I'm sorry, Carlito. You got to say it one more time.
Yeah, no problem. So as one enters the gates of hell, there's a sign above that says, "Abandon hope, all ye who enter here." This is similar to the last line of the poem you read. And so, you know, therefore you need a lot of faith. And so what do you think that that last line is referring to?
Oh, I see. I think what it's saying is hope. This word hope is a hope for a particular result, an expectation, a need to have a certain thing happen. And what we are doing is following the faith that something will happen, but we don't know what it is. Mm-hmm. So there's a need to have faith in the unknown, but you want to abandon this idea of hope if the hope is a particular outcome. So the problem I think we have, this is the problem I had when I first came into Dhamma, is because I came from a Christian background and hope seems so necessary. But I think the Christian understanding of hope is probably more in line with the Dharmic understanding of hope, which is not hope in a particular thing, but hope in the idea that all things work together for good for those who believe. So it doesn't really matter whether the thing that comes in front of you is good, bad, or indifferent. It all kind of works its way out in some kind of wisdom towards your life. That's what you want to abandon, is the hope that I get this, or the hope that this happens, or the hope that it ends up like this. That kind of hope is problematic. It ends up creating an expectation and setting you up for suffering and disappointment. Instead, you want to have the faith that your right efforts are going to lead to a fruitful benefit, that all things will work out in some way that you have no idea how it works out or what works out, but that you have this faith that my efforts, my right efforts, my good actions, my practice is going to lead to awakening, even though you will not be there when awakening happens. So you cannot make yourself awaken. Awakening happens because the mind lets go of you. And then you have the possibility, the mind has the possibility to awaken. So you have to be able to let go of any control on the outcome. That's what I think that's saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sort of almost like maybe hope and craving are kind of interrelated in the way that you're discussing it. Yeah, okay.
That's right. Okay, this hope in it being a certain way. So hope in your meditation being a nice, peaceful, kind meditation, really, really good. You might sit down and your mind is crazy making. But if you sit there thinking, I hope it settles down so I can have a peaceful sit, then you're creating the very suffering that you're trying to get away from. Instead, if you look at the mind as it is, whatever is happening, aversion, irritation, it doesn't like this, it doesn't like that, it's complaining all the time. If you sit with that mind and you're kind with that mind, so I need to just practice being kind with this mind. Let me just be kind with this mind. I don't care. Be kind with this mind. Be kind with this mind. And let it be. It doesn't have to be any other way. You will be shocked at how you can cultivate a level of kindness in that mind. And that mind itself, when you're actually kind with it, it will let go of its aversion. Because you don't let go of the aversion, the mind lets go of the aversion. And so your kindness is just like, you know, a kid learning how to walk. You're going to have to put some pillows around, but really they got to figure it out on their own. They're going to have to plop down and stand up and plop down and stand up, but you can't teach them how to walk. They really got to figure it out. Your daughter had to figure that out on her own.
Right. Thank you. Thanks very much.
So the mind is what I'm talking about, has to figure out how to let go of aversion on its own. And the only thing you can do, Carlito, is be as kind as you can in that aggressive mind until it figures out how to let go. It will. If you soften around it and hold a good space and kindness and just right here, it's okay.
Yeah.
It will not figure it out if you try to make that aggressive mind go away.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Thank you.
I think, Ed, you're the next one. I think it's opposite. Yeah, it's opposite here. So go ahead, Ed.
Hi, Tori.
Hi.
So another way of thinking about this is developing continuous mindfulness. Is that right?
It is. But continuous mindfulness can sound a little bit like we've got to work hard. But we are always mindful. We just don't, we're not necessarily mindful of a particular object, but the mind is always mindful of something. Even a thief is mindful if they're burglarizing your house about whether you hear them or not. Very, very mindful. But that mindfulness is not wholesome. So you're trying to cultivate a wholesome mindfulness of returning to the present moment, right here, right now. No matter what happens, I just want to be right here, right now with the experience. And that cultivation of that mindfulness is what strengthens the concentration. That effort of being here, the mindfulness of the present moment, and this concentration is what builds the samadhi. And that's where that felt sense of leaning back on the ox, resting, kind of open field practice.
And then the insights come from that.
Yes, it comes from that. It's a completely different, it's a different type of wisdom. So we know insights that come from academic learning, training in a field, and we learn things and we understand things and we can put things together, and we understand that cognizing, problem solving capacity of mind. But there is an intuitive mind that is freed from the problem solving type understanding, that has a completely different type of understanding. And that's the mind, this awareness that we want to open up to. And that we can open up to only when we stop trying to make the moment be a certain way. Okay, good. It's got Carla and Ian. You guys are the last peoples.
Okay, well, for a moment there, I thought that Ed's question was going to solve my question, but I'm still confused. My question is, what is the difference between concentration and mindfulness? And for a while, I was thinking, oh, one is sort of Vipassana style, open awareness of whatever's coming and going. And the other is like intentionally directing that awareness to an object like the anchor. But then you said other things that seem to contradict that.
No. I'm still confused. Think of it differently. Think of it as mindfulness as the attention, keeping your attention on something, bringing it back, keeping that attentiveness is the mindfulness, the capacity to remember to put your attention on this, paying attention. The concentration is the ability to sustain your attention on that. So you got this attention, the effort to keep bringing your attention back, the attention that's right there, and then the concentration is this ability to sustain your attention. The only thing of those three things that you can actually do is the choice of where you put your attention and this effort of coming back. But the quality of mind that is mindfulness is an automatic thing that arises out of our minds. This is what the Buddha was. He used mindfulness, which is a natural faculty of the human mind, and that natural faculty of the human mind to remember to pay attention, that faculty is what leads to this concentration. Our right effort towards paying attention to a wholesome anchor, present moment, breath, sound, whatever, something in the present moment, our right effort and choice to constantly bring our attention to that kicks in motion this mindfulness to remember to stay right here, remember to stay right here. And then ultimately, samadhi, which is this concentration, the mind will stay there. We just keep bringing the right effort, right effort, right effort. The mindfulness that's a natural occurring faculty of the mind and concentration begins to happen. And that concentration will happen whether the mind is distracted or not. It will happen whether the mind is sleepy or not, if you keep your attention, your efforts around you don't fight with the sleepiness or fight with the distraction. You keep your attention towards present moment. Do you see the difference?
So it sounds to me like concentration is sustained mindfulness over time. If you could
just say it like that,
continue to be mindful, but mindfulness, not necessarily of just one object like the breath, but mindfulness of whatever is arising and passing away.
Once that sustained capacity happens, then yes, you can be mindful of whatever is arising because the concentration allows for that. The point that I'm trying to point to is oftentimes in this secular way of looking at mindfulness, we can make mindfulness, but it's better to trust that I have the ability to return to my object. That's what our right effort is, what we have. And the mindfulness, the paying attention, and the concentration are faculties of mind that kick in. And that's what helps the mind let go of its struggle.
Okay. Yeah, that does help.
So the way to learn this for everybody is to practice it in the middle of a struggle. That's what I was getting to with that initial story. You got to practice mindfulness, wise attention, concentration in the middle of a struggle so that you're not trying to get the struggle fixed. And instead, you're willing to stay with the struggle so that you can see the mind let go on its own. If we go out and fix these struggles, we never learn that the mind can let go on its own. You don't have to let go. It will. So you may have to practice a little bit and it doesn't let go. It didn't let go. I tried practice. It didn't let go. Okay, try it again. It didn't let go. Okay, try it again. Just keep trying it again. And then when you see it, you will see what was preventing it from letting go in the first place. That's what I'm trying to point to. So if I don't get you sparked with anything tonight, I want you to think about, oh yeah, I'm going to have a bad sit and I'm going to be right there. Stay with it. I'm not going nowhere. I'm going to see whether Tori knows what she's talking about. I better go. Anyway, so Tim will be here next week. I am going to be at Cloud Mountain. We're going to be practicing with stillness, some of us. And so I'm looking forward to that. All righty. Well, thank you so much for staying a little bit later. And I will see you all. I think it's in September. I think next week is Tim and then it's me. All right. Bye-bye.